Welcome to Old Taku No Radio, episode 23, where we're going to be talking about the Mamoru Hosoda film Wolf Children. And here to tell us a little bit about that is the indefatigable Ink.
Hana is a 19-year-old student who falls in love with the mysterious lone wolf of a man, who's actually a lone wolf man. Hana gives birth to two children, the eldest Yuki, which is snow in Japanese, and the youngest Ame, which is rain in Japanese. At first, the family tries to live as quietly as they can in the city, but when tragedy strikes, Hana moves the children to a rural town and starts from scratch. Get it? As claws.
Oh, I was trying so hard to move on from that, but you were not going to let that go, were you?
No.
Oh, God.
Bad puns must be realized.
Yes. Oh. So yeah, this one hits me on very many levels. There's a lot of things in my life that I see that this movie really can kind of like get to me in a lot of ways. You know, when I was a very, very young boy, my mom was taking care of me, and she had more help than Hana did, thankfully. But you know, had to do a lot of the work and the hard work that you see Hana do throughout the film. Just reminded me of kind of how it was for my mom when I was a young Ame myself, and so working mom movie just right in the guts, man, for me. Emotionally, I feel like this is a very powerful movie, a very impactful movie. You know, I think a lot of that had to do with my own personal circumstances and how I related to the movie. But you know, Hosoda is pretty good at just tugging them heartstrings in a more of an understated way than some of his contemporaries, I think. But I really enjoyed this, and I've been. You know, we've had it on our list to cover for a while, and I was glad that we finally had a chance to do it. So, broad strokes, thoughts, Ink. What did you think of the movie?
Certain aspects about Hana just really hit home, and you know, even though this movie's it focuses through the death of a spouse, and then the assumptive role the parent has to play as the only caregiver and upbringer, also works like my experience. My parents divorced when I was six, and my mom was that workaholic sole parent who just had to take care of the kids because my dad really wasn't in the picture all that much. And you know, so that's it was just heart-wrenching watching the woman as she grows and learns to let her children go, which is a huge part of this.
Yeah, that I had wondered, you know, this was my first time seeing the movie, and I had wondered how they were going to handle that aspect of the story, because I felt like from a plot standpoint, when you have a movie about a mother and her children and motherly love being like a big theme. You know, and this would be true for any parent, but I think mothers would argue that they feel it a little differently. At least I know that a lot of the ones I know probably would. Is that idea of the separation, you know, and having to let your children grow and go and be the people that they become. And without getting too much into spoilers, they managed to pull that off without really it being terribly contrived. I kind of came into this movie halfway expecting we'd see this whole woman's life, you know, like played out before us. And that's not what happens. And it was refreshing in a way to see that that's not the way they went with this. I think they very easily could have.
Yeah, I mean, for a film that covers such a long expanse of time, because you have the initial, you know, meeting of the couple, their brief courtship and then the birth of the children, and then the life after, up until like they're in middle school, I think, or they're just middle school aged. That's a lot of time for a movie to cover, especially if you're gonna just show development of each of those characters, and it plays out fairly smoothly. And thinking back on it, it really shouldn't, because it plays so montage-y. But that's kind of the film's strength too, is just showing movement of time through pictures as opposed to narration, and saying, okay, 5 years later, and then having them dole out plot point after plot point and dialogue.
Yeah, it's an incredibly economic film for the breadth of time it tells a story in. And it uses the kind of clever way they do that is, and again, in a way that resonates so powerfully, is, you know, the measuring of the kids on the beam in the house, right? You know, that's such a clever, you know, that trope has been used before, but it's highly effective, and it can be highly effective when it's used well, and they use it well here. So yeah, it I mean, you know, they could have been writing a whole dictionary in this time frame, because I think it's, you know, about a decade plus, maybe 12 years, something around that much. It gets away with it somehow, and I feel like we'll probably get more into it in a minute, but I feel like the music helps play a role there. I felt like there was a really strong alignment between the art and the motion in different scenes and the music. And I feel like that was so in alignment that it really just helps drive the pace of the story along, and it really doesn't feel, it's not a short movie for an animated movie. It's a 2-hour movie, almost on the dot. So it's not like you're getting shortchanged in your runtime. It just flows exceptionally well.
The music is definitely a character in its own, and it's beautiful. It's beautiful in the way most sad and emotionally engrossing movies tend to be. It's strings and keys, and man, do they play that up! But I can't resist it.
No, I mean, it's very effective. You know, the thing I like to say about tropey things or things you see a lot is that if you know, you don't only ever eat one pizza in your life, right? Like, you'll eat a pizza and it's great, and then you enjoy that experience, and then you have another pizza, and not all art is this way, but I think a lot of art is kind of this way, and that you can see a kind of story over and over again, as long as it's done well. No one wants to eat a bad pizza, right? But I absolutely
want go to Shinkan. Sorry.
Yeah. I want to absolutely keep eating pizza. So now that I've tortured that metaphor to death, that's all in the service of saying this is not a groundbreaking story in terms of how, you know, the base elements of it are, you know, singular or anything. That's not the case. I do think it's a bit unusual for an anime in that it covers a working mother as like a central, if not the central character. It's kind of hard to to know if the kids are more the main character or if she's the more main character of the main character. It's certainly told from the perspective of, here's the story of my mom, right? For her to be, you know, a working mother and be like a main character in an anime, let alone an animated movie, that itself is a pretty unique thing.
That's where I kind of found fault with the movie. Is the only thing I don't like about it is, if you're going to have a narrator who is the eldest daughter narrating this film, but it end with the mother alone saying, like, live a good life. That was the ending scene, right?
Yeah. She's kicking it by, like, so we're into full spoiler territory here, but
Wait. You don't have to spoil it, but it's her alone addressing some event that she's only witness to, right?
It's the daughter kind of talking about, well, it's kind of the daughter talking about the happily ever after question mark for her mom. And like what her mom goes on to do.
And that's where I feel the film could have done a lot more. Like, it could have switched gears. It could have made mom the first half, or the first, you know, or the middle half, because the first is very much the couple. And then the mom could have been the middle half, and then the kids could have been the third. And it starts to divulge that way, because everyone starts going their own path. The eldest daughter decides, you know, she wants to be human, and she starts living life as a human because it's easier for her that way. The younger boy starts to live as a wolf because he feels drawn more that way. And the mother has to learn to let go and let her children decide. And her arc kind of ends there, but the movie doesn't let it end there. It draws out the emotional attachment all the way towards the end. Mm-hmm. And that attachment is needed. And but, you know, it really feels like the film should follow the children, at least to a point where they both disappear from the mother's life.
Well, it kind of does, though.
It does with Ame. I don't think it does with Yuki.
It kind of does. Yeah. So.
Oh, that's right.
All right. Sorry. It's spoiler time. Buckle up. So Ame, the younger brother, who's a bit quieter, a bit more introspective, like Ink said, he chooses the animal life because he's kind of always felt closer to that. And he goes on basically to become the guardian of the mountain after an elderly fox that kind of mentors Ame, you know, can no longer do it because he breaks his leg in a storm or something. You know, plot contrivance, Ame has to fulfill in the job of being the guardian of nature in the area. And Yuki, on the other hand, like Ink also said, chooses to be a human. But at the end of the movie, it doesn't let, like Yuki's not just like hanging out with mom and like living with mom anymore. She goes on to middle school, but when she goes on to middle school, she like moves into the dorms at the middle school, which, to be fair, it does say you've already just gotten through 2 hours of a very emotional movie, and you're probably not thinking of all the plot points carefully laid out to like help explain why that decision would be the decision that Yuki makes. But it does say when they move out to the country that the junior high school is like 3 hours away or something, one way. I mean, they are in the woods. And so Hana, the mother, by the end of the film, really has kind of had to let go of both of her children. They have both moved on into their own life, and you know, they've moved on. They've left the house already. So she is alone. She is by herself. But in the way that they play that off is, oh, you know, she lived a life of contentment, you know, by herself, and the end. And so the ending, the denouement of it all could have been better.
And hearing you talk about that, there's two things. There's I totally agree that that decision is what's meant to be on par with Ume's departure. But because we're so familiar with human life, and because going off to boarding school is such a normal thing, the drama should have really been amped up there. It just feels like it's so normal. That's why it sank below my memory. Like, yeah. Oh yeah, she's going off to the boarding school. Well,
and
whatever.
It's kind of tagged on at the end too. You spend all of this dramatic action with Hana coming to realize that she has to let go of Ame and let Ame pursue the path that he's chosen for himself. And you know, you have Yuki, who figures into the story from an emotional standpoint a lot more earlier in the story. She's kind of hanging out at school trying to hide because there's a storm coming. And we just kind of leave her there for like 20 minutes of this film at least. And, you know, she has a conversation with a friend who also plays an important part in the story. But yeah, that's all you get. She kind of gets pushed to the side in favor of what I guess is the more dramatic kind of finish of Ame choosing a life where he's living in the, on the mountain as a wolf and really kind of not entirely abandoning his humanity or anything like that. But he is definitely moving away from it. And, you know, the Yuki kind of resolution gets sort of just bolted on at the end. It's that part was a little not quite satisfying, honestly. Mm. But like, what would they have done? Like, you know, on the other...
I want to see everybody broken, Jared. Just broken. Because, you know, she's entering her, you know, middle school years, so her hormones are flaring. She's already got like the in-school boyfriend. I want her to go, you know, screw it. I've been being reserved and supporting my parents all this time. You know what? What about me? What about me? I'm going to go be happy and, you know, be this half a person I am. And that's another thing they never really fully explore is like them battling with the halves of each other. They just sort of decide the direction more or less pits them as halves of a whole.
Yeah.
So not two children, but one children, but two halves. So you have your human side, you have your wolf. I found them much more interesting as children, honestly.
Yeah, they make that a binary choice. And I agree with you, like as kids, it's interesting because there's a fluidity between their identity and the father, yeah. If you remember the father whose name we never really get. But the father has a, an interesting take where he's kind of blended that together. Like he's both, and being both, and maybe this is the lesson that the kids draw from it, even though, you know, Ame was barely a baby and Yuki was probably too young to remember. So maybe it's sort of Hana and the way Hana raises them that impresses this on their brain. But he tried the way of being kind of both and ended up dead.
Early on, he has that conflict when they're reading all the children's books to the kids to get asleep, and there leaves that lasting impression of why is the wolf always bad? And by that time, they have already fully realized they're wolf children, and it's like, hey, why am I awful? You can see how it affects them in different ways, which is kind of cool. Ame, you know, rebels and, you know, it's like, no, I'm gonna be more wolf to be this better, prove them wrong sort of thing, and Yuki's more. Hey, you know what? I'm going to live like mom and, you know, live the life she lives.
Yeah. I mean, it's nice from like a storytelling perspective within the confines of a movie. You kind of have to tell the story, I think, the way they did, at least where one kind of chooses to be human over being a wolf and the other chooses being a wolf over being a human. But I would have liked to seen a little more of the kids' internal lives around that point, you know, which we don't get. But you know what we really don't get, I don't think is enough of, is Hana's internal life, oddly enough, because we see so much of her taking care of the kids and really in almost this superhuman kind of way, just constantly being optimistic, never breaking down in front of them, except one time where she almost does, but she plays it off with a smile. And they explain that in the movie too, about how Hana was taught to smile through sadness. So every time she's smiling, it's really awful. You go, oh God, she's like dying inside.
But is she or isn't she dying inside? And the animation on her face really does a good job at conveying which it is or maybe which it is, at least installing the ambiguity. I think a lot of the movie, how it grows the Hana's character is more through passage of time and silence than it is by actual plot development, which I think a lot of people may be reading as their sort of benchmarks of character growth, because there are a ton of moments where Yuki is in silence observing her children, even right down to the very last when she's watching her eldest, you know, leap into the forest, and she just decides, you know, Ume actually decides that, you know, he has to turn around and leave. But there's a moment, there's a transition within Hana as she watches him go that restricts her or recoils her outstretched hand. And, you know, she's like, no, this is how he's going to be. I have to accept it. There's a lot of growth through moments like that. There's a moment earlier in the forest when she's chasing him through this torrential rain, where she's blindly chasing after the silhouette walking in a forest, thinking it's him walking away, because turns out to be something different. Turns out to be another part of nature, just a bear walking. But you can infer from that imagery, she being solely human and chasing into this forest, this wilderness, this unknown, and encountering an image of something she conceives to be her own, and then that turning out not to be her own, that's a divining moment of humanity realizing it is outside of nature. And she kind of realizes in that moment that that's not her place. And she presses on because of a motherly conviction, not because of a natural conviction. Well, I came out completely wrong, but it's a difference of conviction.
Yeah. Another thing about both of the scenes you mentioned, there's parts of those that I think really resonated with me. I'm going to take them on in reverse order. So with the bear encounter, there's absolutely this encounter with this creature, and there's this moment of fear, like, oh God, this bear is going to eat me. And then the bear cubs come up. And I read that as, oh, this is a mother bear doing what Hana's doing right now. And there's this kind of like, I see you, human. I see what you're trying to do. This is what I'm trying to do. It was, you know, like this moment of, yes, Hana's never going to understand that world the way that Ame can and will. But at the same time, at a absolutely fundamental level, she sees another mother with her children trying to protect them from the elements and the storm, and she gets that just in this elemental way, which I thought was really, I thought that was a great scene that helps her get to the next kind of big emotional note, which is when she finally, you know, at the climax of the story, she finally comes to peace with the fact that Ame is choosing this life with his eyes open, and he knows this is the life he needs to have and the path he needs to walk. And there's this visual exchange from them or with them where she's sort of breaking down, and she says, you know, isn't there anything more I can teach you, or something like that. And the look on Ame's face of kind of, he finally gets it. He finally realizes what he's about to do to her. And, you know, it's this just horrified, like, I am hurting her doing this, but I have to do it. So I have to go. And he turns and looks at her with this sad, very human kind of, even though he's in a wolf form, very human kind of look of regret and pain and sadness. And then he bounds off into the woods and up the mountain, and he's gone.
But the way the animation portrays that bound, like, bound is inherently kind of joyous. This is more running away. Like, it's running full speed just to avoid that confrontation, even though he's fully, you know, recognized it, acknowledged it, and, you know, purposefully moving on from it. But that's definitely a get me the hell out of here as soon as I can, just so I can deal with this.
That's absolutely true. But something that's a great counter juxtaposition to that is the music at the time is this sort of rising kind of music, this sort of triumphant rising action kind of music. And then you have the visual of him kind of running up the switchbacks of the mountain and, you know, it breaks it into the clouds and all that stuff. And like, it's beautiful because it's a scene that has this somewhat bittersweet, you know, note of running away. But then also you have this moment of triumph too. And I think, you know, if you've ever had a moment in your life where you can like really definitively say, okay, this is the moment I stepped out on my own and I became an adult and I started living on my own in a real kind of way. Like I am here are my parents like sending me off, wishing me well, kind of moment. It was that moment, like to a T emotionally. And, I mean, it's the climax of the movie, right? But I mean, just such a good scene, layered too.
And as you were saying about the character versus background animation,
the backgrounds are really lovingly made, very evocative,
very rich,
incredibly rich and frothy and delicious.
Oh, hold on. Yes, they are.
One of us may be drinking beer. Guess who? Anyhow, the backgrounds are exceptionally detailed, very evocative, very rich, and you get this real sense of being transported into rural Japan, like the Inaka, as it's called. Like, that rural Japan is such a different world than the Japan that so many of us know through pop culture, of the glitzy, you know, Tokyo or Kyoto or Osaka skylines and all the big TVs on the side of buildings and the Times Square looking kind of stuff. And it's so different. And as someone who spent some time in a place not nearly as Inaka as where they were, because I was an hour away from, you know, a big city, but you know, it really nailed that feeling of being in the wilderness, and in country living, I guess you could call it, in a way that I don't think I've seen very many movies do a successful job of doing. Even something that's sort of centered around a rural lifestyle like Silver Spoon, you still feel like, you know, they can get to Tokyo or you know, anywhere in a major kind of city without too much trouble. It's like a scene transition, but here there's like a real, in this movie, there's a real separation between the city and the country, and that transition that Hana makes from city to country, it has this finality to it, and I'm glad that they own that through the whole film.
Mm. Yeah, I gotta admit, my favorite character is none of the main cast. It's totally the old guy who hates the newcomer. He is just so perfect as the curmudgeon-y old man who, you know, is just tsundere, basically.
He really is, because he simultaneously like gives her a hard time, even later in the film, continues giving her a hard time. And then meanwhile, everywhere else he talks, all he's doing is talking about her and how people need to go help her do this, that, and the other, because she doesn't know how to do it. And, you know, trying to make her integrated into the countryside, because like none of these people live like right next door to each other. Like, everybody's like miles away from each other. you know, to the point where like they have to worry about wild animals getting into their fields, which Hana doesn't have that problem because she's got two small wolves guarding the place the whole time. They're also her kids.
Not even gardening. My favorite point in this film is actually the realization that her kids are just pissing out in the fields as wolves, because there's a point where everyone's crops are being devastated by this wild boar except Hana's place. And the townspeople come to her and they're like, "What's your secret? You know, you're a newcomer and we've given you all our help, but somehow your crops are surviving past ours." And she just has this light that bulb that goes on after, you know, one of her small kids has to go to the bathroom. And it's like, oh, because they're marking their territory and Wolf Fist guards against them.
See, that's funny. I didn't even pick that up at all. Like that, but that makes all the sense in the world.
It was really good. And there's like little bits of that throughout the whole film. It's not heavily laid on, it's just out there, and it's a lot of fun just to pick up on as the movie goes along.
And this is a film, you know, speaking of things not heavily laid on, this is a film, despite its emotional impact, you're not just beaten over the head with things. You know, the most emotionally impactful parts of the film are probably the death of the father.
For a couple of reasons, like that's worth expanding upon. Like, sure, you're empathizing with this woman who has lost the love of her life, but you're also witnessing the cruelty of animal or the indifference with which humanity regards animals as sort of the separate, just sort of organic matter. Because when the wolf is, you know, killed by a street accident or something, he's literally just bagged, thrown in the back of a dump
Well,
truck, and crushed.
let's not leave out the fact that he was also just floating in a canal too, you know, where he had probably been hit and then like got away and died. And you know, yeah, he's unceremoniously picked up by his hind legs, stuffed in a bag, and this is all happening in front of Hana's eyes. She has both of her kids strapped to her, and she sees the love of her life being tossed away like garbage after being pulled out of the water like a piece of trash. And it's absolutely gut-wrenching. It's one of the most gut-wrenching things I think I've ever seen, like ever seen in an animated thing ever. I mean, it's just a gut-wrenching thing in general, especially if you like dogs, which I do. But you layer on top of the relationship, the romance that they've built up here, the young couple and their children, that you see this family unit that you've gotten to know for the last, and they spend about a half hour, you know, going from Hana meeting the wolf man to them getting together to them having a family, and then boom, here we go. And it's just it's horrifying to have seen that. And you know, I kind of figured, because you can read the back of the box and go, okay, he dies, and obviously he has to, it's there, something has to happen for her to be on her own with the two kids. But it's really, really, really gut-wrenching to see that whole thing happen. I feel like I'm just going on and on about it now, but I mean, it really is. Just thinking about it again, just, you know,
It's a strong point of film.
it's oof. You want to talk about, you know, inciting incident in a plot for a film. That's a pretty intense one.
I think what you're getting around at is, you know, you can see it coming, and you're still not going to be ready for the
Not
effect.
at all.
It's all due to the animation too. Like you said, the way the wolf is quote unquote unceremoniously picked up. Just that raw disregard for humanity or for nature, just the two people dragging the wolf up by the hind legs and the way it dangles openly in front of everyone, and then, you know, just bagged and thrown, and all the animation. It's not anything super detailed, but it's very purposeful. Like, they knew what they were doing when they modeled each scene.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of that throughout.
It's a film that, you know, again, for the ending not being quite as complete as I think Ink and I probably would have wanted it, it's a film that does some incredible things with emotional storytelling, but does not beat you over the head with it, which was what I was referencing earlier when we were talking about, you know, not laying things on too thickly. It doesn't do that. Even in a scene like that, where it's dramatic and impactful, it doesn't linger on the scene any longer than it has to. And that's one of the things that I think this film does particularly well, even among Hosoda films.
There is one image that I really loved, like above all else, because as much as the sort of the backgrounds betray the character design's flatness, there's one image during a storm that's sweeping the area, and it knocks. There's a scene where Hana is waiting inside the house, just sort of knitting or folding. She's folding clothes. And Ume is at a table just sort of sitting there waiting because her mom, you know, his mom doesn't want her, want him to go out into the forest anymore. And there's just this sense of restriction. And there's a view of a room in back of another room that's only seen through split sliding doors. And the way the scene appears in light, it looks totally natural, like they're together, and then the lights cut out. And the way the same scene is illuminated by just the darkness of outside coming through the house betrays this inner scene where Ume is completely shut off from his mother, except from everything inanimate. The sliding doors cut the mother off from him, and the only thing connecting the two scenes, that the mother in the foreground and the Ume in the background, is a table that stretches from in the foreground between the sliding door and the background, and the mother's folded laundry. So it's a very, very separate connection. It's a gorgeous scene, and it's two. You can just see the two pictures back to back, and it's amazing. It really is. It's the most artistic shot in the film.
It is a beautiful shot.
But that's this movie doesn't rely on those types of shots. It's just sort of nice that they're in there.
Something else that you brought up in our talking points for the film that I wanted you to start off on. I've got some thoughts too, but you mentioned silence as being a key piece of the storytelling in Wolf Children. Do you want to unpack that a little bit?
I've touched on it a little already. It's a lot of moments where, well, literally and physically, there's a lot of play in this movie where there's no dialogue. It's just either a montage or a scene where nothing really needs to be said. And there's maybe background music, but there's all storytelling via visual. Facial reactions come in a lot to play, whether they're restricted or going all out. That's pretty much it. I mean, this series really knows how to manipulate via not saying as well as saying.
I agree with that. I feel like, you know, one of the things that I think we see often in Japanese art, like movies and anime and things, is an idea of companionable silence. And how silence between people can convey more sometimes than words quite can. And I feel like the companionable silence we see in a lot of scenes of the film where, you know, the mom's, you know, cooking and she has a smile on her face because she can hear just the kids being kids in the background and the patter of their two and sometimes four legs running around in excitement, and the sometimes the more painful silence too, where you've got Yuki crying in a bathtub, and Ame storms off, and there's just this stillness where moments before there was a hurricane of two wolves, you know, completely tornadoing their way through a house, you know, fighting each other. The silence and those beats of silence, even where there's not even any music or anything, really, really powerful and really well done. And it's not always so well done. Yep. Go ahead.
That's okay.
Yeah. I was just going to say, it's not always so well done as it was in Wolf Children, I think, and used really as a storytelling tool in quite the same way.
And I think you can really point it out to yourself. Like, this was my second watch, so I tried to approach it a little more critically than I did the first. The first time I was just bawling my eyes out. Second time I was still crying, but it was more reserved as I tried to appreciate all the storytelling that went into this. And I stopped myself every time. It's going to sound horrible. I stopped myself every time I began to feel, but just to really focus on how the scene was being constructed and what elements were in play. And 9 times out of 10, I would be like, holy shit, when's the last time I heard a word said?
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, there can be dialogue, but it's not expositionary. It's just people having a conversation, and it's not necessarily, you know, betraying a plot point. It's just a natural conversation that anyone would have on any given day, given the situation.
And there's not a lot of expository dialogue anyway, like just in the film in general. It seems to be, you know, again, pretty economical with, you know, its pacing and what it's conveying visually and what it's saying. And, you know, for me, watching it this first time, I was so sucked into things that I would hear the silence and I would feel it and I would acknowledge it, but I was so emotionally channeled through this movie that I really didn't have time to step back away from it. And, you know, with, you know, divorcing myself from it a little bit like you did and go, oh, you know, that's been a couple minutes since I've heard a word, you know, I was just kind of just enthralled. Especially once it really gets going, as much as a movie like this gets going, like it's almost incongruous that a movie where there's no like psychic powers blowing anything up, there's no explosions, there's no anything, has so much dramatic tension running throughout it, because you kind of, especially the watching it the first time through, you're kind of constantly afraid for Hana and her kids that something's going to happen, that somehow they're going to get found out and then they're gonna have to run. And like, I was waiting with kind of my breath held in to a degree throughout the entire movie for that kind of awful thing to happen. And I was so relieved when it didn't, even when, you know, there's a point in the movie where it looks like Yuki's about to have her cover blown. And it ends up okay. It's really well done in a lot of ways, this film.
In a lot of ways, but not in all ways, because what this really is the afterword to all those Japanese folktales where the lonely woodsman fucks a swan. That's all it is. I mean, but it's following that path with its own truth. And I think one of the most touching visuals of that, at least framed within the context of this newly widowed mother, is when her son gets sick. I think it's her son.
Yeah.
Maybe it's her daughter.
No, it's pretty sure it's Ame.
Okay. So her son gets sick for the first time, like really seriously. And, you know, she has been, the family has been taking care of their own exclusively, but this is something she does not know how to deal with. So she wanders into town, and she's literally at a crossroads between a children's doctor and a veterinarian. And, you know, it's laughable, but you put yourself in the put yourself in the shoes of that mother. And
actually, you're right. It was Yuki, because this is when she ate silica gel or something like that. And then she she ends up just calling a helpline because she doesn't know what else to do. And that scene is great for a couple reasons, because one, it illustrates the world that she's now in, where she has to kind of hide these kids from the world. And the other half of it, where, you know, she has to, you know, she does not have all of the tools at her disposal that a normal single mother would. You know, she can't just walk into a clinic, you know, like a normal single mother could. There's both this need for secrecy, and there's this gross lack of knowledge about how to care for wolf children. And that is so, again, that might be one of the most economical scenes in this whole movie, because it conveys all of these things in a very short amount of time. And you get this real appreciation for what Hannah's having to deal with. And that, I think, was the start of me like having like near panic attacks every time it was like about to come to pass that the kids might, their cover might be blown.
Yeah. Like going back to my initial investment in this, their cover being blown very easily equated to memories of my mom flipping out because I was nowhere to be seen for several hours at a time. And she would call the police because she did not know where I was. And she feared for the life of her, me and my brother getting taken away from her, custody and given to my father, at the time. And like, there's nothing in the film to suggest, a divorce parallel, but it's just something personal that I brought to it. And it was a very direct parallel that the execution of this, her character, brought.
Yeah.
And it was powerful and it was well done. And I was just like, okay, this is easily relatable.
Well, and
way too.
The incident that sort of sparks Hannah to take the kids into the country is that, you know, basically DHR comes to check on her because her kids have never had vaccinations or anything like that. So, you know, they start to draw suspicion. And when they do, it's sort of like this real moment of panic, this moment of crisis, because Hannah does not know what she's going to do. And then she comes to make the decision, well, we need to move to the country where I guess DHR can't come or would have a hard time coming.
Well, we'll say she sold the house or wherever she was living for cash and moved out to such a cheap place where she could buy for cash and thus be kind of untraceable.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, think about that. Like totally having to just drop off the radar. And you know, and then she takes the job at the animal conservatory so she can know more about
so
animals,
too.
Namely the wolf they have in captivity, and ends up, you know, like that really kind of ends up leading to Ame kind of, I think, contributes to his path of where he ends up. So like that's an interesting thing, I guess. But you know, she's told, like, you know, a high schooler with a part-time job is going to make more money than you, which, by the way, I think is tremendously unfair that people working in an animal conservatory would somehow make less money than, you know, somebody working at a freaking McDonald's. Like that's not fair.
To be honest, how often do you visit a McDonald's versus how often do you visit a conservatory?
Not nearly as much as I used to, but I take your point.
But I agree. It is a totally unfairly weighted pay scale there.
There's a degree of realism in this movie, even though we're talking about a movie called Wolf Children. There's a degree of realism in this movie, I think, that really separates it from other movies like it, because this could be some saccharine, you know, just waste of time, but it doesn't really like that feels kind of plausible, right? That she would go and try to get this job and then it would pay like nothing. And, you know, she'd have to struggle through that too on top of everything else. And like, you know, Hannah just is relentless, you know, possessed of this absolute desperation and will to make sure that her kids are safe and that they grow up happy. And, you know, she kind of loses sight of the fact that she wants her kids to be happy above all for a second, because, you know, again, she's afraid of losing them. But I feel like that thread they actually resolved fairly well. Just the end where we just bolt on the stuff with Yuki was just kind of like, why did we not carry that forward a little more? are we ready for Twitter questions? You got anything else you wanted to cover?
One of the things I also didn't find quite as endearing the second time around was the ease with which the characters accepted the, oh, hey, you're a thing of myth. You're a half wolf, half man or woman. And it happens in both places. When Hannah finally, or when the wolfman finally reveals to Hannah his true nature, you know, it's this very touching, kind of odd scene. Reminded me a lot of the original werewolf with the transformation. some of the bulges in the character design and such. And he's not like a very pretty wolfman. It's I like the form they chose for him. But by that same stake, like, she should have been a little more wigged out. she makes it a little too accepting of that revelation. And when that happens again betwixt one of her kids,
Yuki and Sosuke, yeah, the kid.
Sosuke or Soze? Well, either. Doesn't matter. You know, when that happens, he's like, oh, yeah, I knew all along. I was just protecting your secret. And whether that's just bluster or...
Sohei,
I think, yeah. And whether that's whether his acceptance is just bluster in the moment to look strong in front of her, or it's actual acceptance, which I think the film would rather have you believe. And it, again, just seems like, no, this dude would be like bolting. This is a 12-year-old kid, and no.
I don't know. I think a kid that age would be far more accepting of magical realism than a mostly grown college-age woman. Personally,
and you do add the stress he's been going under at home. He's his dad has married a new woman, so maybe he's looking for a bit of an escape.
I don't know, man. Like I think that you know, kids that young are still kids enough that there's a part of them that would believe something extraordinary like that without a ton of convincing, right?
Also, you have to go into the mythology of Japan and how they're raised.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh.
And maybe you can extend that to Hannah. I do agree that, you know, this is probably one point in the movie where they really, you know, they're already in a relationship by the time that he reveals himself to her.
Mm-hmm.
They're not together yet, but they do kind of push through that awfully quick. But, I mean, for the purposes of the story they're trying to tell, would it have served the story to have drugged that out? And they've only got 2 hours. You know, TV series, maybe.
Sure, they've already got 2 hours, yeah.
Yeah, because you're already probably 10 or 15 minutes into the movie by the time you get that far, right? They actually spend more time on their courtship than I would have imagined.
All right, so Twitter questions. Unless you have something.
Nah. I feel like I risk repeating myself if I don't stop now. So the first Twitter question is from Helen at Wandering Dreamer, who's been on the show previously for Eccentric Family. And on a scale of 1 to 10, how much of a furry is Hosoda? Ink, you are eminently qualified to answer this question. So please.
Wait, how?
Because you're going to answer it before I am.
Jesus. Okay, so We have The Boy and the Beast, which I have not seen, but features a young boy and an obvious sort of mentor-fatherly relationship with a big bear. Take that as you want, Community. So the only other Minnesota film I've seen is The Girl Who Leapt Through Time. That involves no furries. And given that this film actually sees one implied sexual encounter, which is obviously a sexual encounter of the furry kind, and then one a little later on where two teens are staying late night in the school and one reveals herself to be a wolf in front of the other kid. This is probably the most furry of his films. How much of a furry is he? I don't know. I'm more inclined to think that he's acting on a culture based around a lot of mythology with animals who come around and transform into human beings to help people who have shown them general kindness, and sort of takes that to the next level. I'm not convincing myself that he's not a furry very well. So I'm going to say he's like a 6 on the furry scale.
I have seen most of his films at this point. I have seen The Girl Who Leapt Through Time, which we covered. Was that last year we covered that for Old Taku No Radio?
It's Elliot.
Yeah, with Elliot. Yeah. And then Summer Wars I've seen. I have just now seen Wolf Children, and I've also seen The Boy and the Beast. So I have seen all four of his movies that aren't a Digimon movie or a One Piece movie. I'm saying firm 7. Firm 7. For all of the reasons that Ink cited, and Summer Wars, when people become their sort of internet avatars, the main love interest basically turns into a girl bunny. Not a bunny girl, but a girl bunny.
Mm-hmm.
And The Boy and the Beast also great movie. It kind of reminds me of The Jungle Book if The Jungle Book was in a city. So we should maybe do that one time. But yeah, it's good stuff. So Helen, absolutely. I say a firm 7. If we round, it's like maybe what is that 6.5? I don't know.
And before the internet community jumps all over me for not having seen Summer Wars, I forgot to say that I have actually seen Summer Wars, so don't worry about that.
Yep, internet community, you can stand down and jump on someone else for something else. I'm sure you'll find something.
Go punch a Nazi.
That would be a good place to start.
Mm.
The next question is from @RexTyne. So thank you, Rex Tyne, for your question. What is y'all's take on the not wholly unfair critique that the portrayal of Hana as a totally self-sacrificing single mother without the agency / space to deal with her own shit, parentheticals, she never melts down or gets mad, is somewhat problematic?
Jared?
I kind of feel like that's bullshit.
How so?
Like, so she has the agency and the space to deal with her own stuff. We see her dealing with her own stuff throughout the entire movie. Her own stuff is her two damn children. like that is her life. And she is the parent. She is the mother and the father. She is everybody. She is their world for most of their life until they go on and we have some scenes that talk about them and their own path they take as people. But I think that between the fact that we establish really early on that she smiles when she's sad because like that's how she gets through pain, and the fact that she is absolutely devoted to protecting these unique, beautiful children of hers that can't ever fully belong to one world or another. Yeah, I think she's got all the agency in the world to do that stuff. The reason they survive is because she's got the agency to move out to the country and sacrifice her entire future that she could have had with her, university, you know, education to raise these kids, and to do it the right way. That's not having the agency. That's making a principled decision as a parent. And, you know, my own mom had to do something similar to that. So maybe that's why I'm so animated about it. But, you know, I don't think for a second Hana doesn't have agency or the space to deal with her own stuff. I think the emotional journey that we are on through this film is seeing her deal with her own stuff. She goes from being on her own, not knowing how to take care of these kids, being absolutely heartbroken, to being strong enough of a person, let alone a mother, to let her kids walk the path they've chosen and be there for them, but not be, you know, helicoptering over them the entire time. That is a huge evolution in 2 hours. So if there's a critique where she doesn't have any agency, I just don't agree with that. Sorry. Ink?
I'm going to tread along the same line. I think it may seem like that, but it depends on what kind of people you've known growing up and who you are at the moment you watch this. If you are a parent, a dedicated parent, a real parent, not just someone who, you know, forgot a condom, you're going to realize that your life is over once you have children, in the sense that, like Jared said, your children are now your life, because you dedicate your life to raising them and having them be the best people they can be, as safe as they can be, as well fed as they can be, as well educated as they can be, as kind to others as they can be, or whatever your family values are. But like I said before, I think a lot of the miscommunication about the lack of agency, if there is such perceived, comes from the use of silence in this film. And like Jared noted, you know, the main character, Hana, you know, sort of swallowing everything in a smile, as her father taught her to do, or her mother.
I think it was her dad. Yeah. I think it was her dad when her dad died. That's what
it
was.
But in any case, there are several moments in the film where you see her struggling, not only physically, but mentally. And this alone is agency. She's hearing the gossip at the new neighborhood store she moved into to get a fresh start and get away from everyone. And when she's, you know, forced to be around people, she hears them, you know, chatting behind her back. That dialogue in the street shop, that's not for her benefit. That's for our benefit of knowing that she's being talked about and she can hear it. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't give her non-agency any tread whatsoever, because as far as I can see it, she is a suffering single mother whose life is her children, but she is taking active steps to make their lives as great as possible. And she's suffering because of it. And suffering is not a lack of agency.
Yeah. I mean, that suffering is something that a lot of characters in fiction have to deal with as part of their growth and their journey. And I certainly think Hana falls squarely into that. And, you know, she's not in a position to do what a lot of parents could do. Like even single parents have help, right, from family a lot of times. And, you know, she doesn't even have that. You know, she's got people in the community, though, that do kind of look after her and look after the kids a little bit, you know, but not on the same level of, hey, I need to go take a vacation. Can you watch the kids for a few days? That's not an option for her. And not only that, she has to be careful with the people she does have, because she doesn't want them to know that her kids are basically werewolves. So,
oh, isn't that cute? The dog and your little girl have matching outfits.
Yeah, which, you know, if we're talking my dog, that's not terribly unreasonable, but, like, you know, that's the kind of danger that she's in. And that scene actually is a great illustrator of, even though she's built this community and she's become a part of this community, there's still danger. She's still kind of, whether she likes it or not, quote unquote, an other, where she can't fully open up to these people, even though they are fully opening up to her.
Mm.
So, I mean, given what she's a hero, man. Like, she's like kicking all the ass, as far as I can tell. But you got any closing thoughts on this one, man?
I love you, Mom.
Yeah, no kidding. Here's to all the mamas.
Seriously. No, I'm pretty good. I think we've set our piece on this piece.
Yeah, yeah, same here. So, Ink, where can people find you on the internet?
So you can find me on the Tweety Box at Animated Ink. If you're inclined to move over to Mastodon, a decentralized social network, I'm also Ink over there. You can find me on the Taiku Podcast as their official bad sports anime correspondent. I'm going to be appearing soon on the Anime is Lit podcast to talk about Chihaya Furu again. And on anagamers.com, I produce the 3-episode test column and co-host with my excellent co-host, Jared, for this very podcast, the Old Taku No Radio podcast. Jared, where can we find you?
You can find me most reliably on Twitter at Save versus Jared. I am also on Mastodon, not nearly as much as I should be. Also at Save versus Jared on Mastodon. And that's it. So for myself, for Ink, thank you guys very much. We'll see you again real soon with another episode of Old Taku No Radio.
Fing. Thank God for the mute button. And then you have this one. The only other episode I've seen is Girl Who Slept Through Time. That sounded wrong. The Girl Who Leapt Through Time.
Girl Who Slept
It's time, whore.
The girl who slept through time. I wasn't even going there. I was going in like she just is asleep at a desk at a school for the whole movie.
Hello. And
that's Walter. Done. Oh, wow.